Welcome back, everybody, and welcome to those of you that are here for the first time. We're just a tad discombobulated on a couple of fronts tonight, so bear with us. We're going to go old school. Our tech people weren't able to come, so this won't be, thank you so much, won't be by PowerPoint. I'm going to go old school with flip charts, just because I like the visual aids. Pretty much going to be the same information. It's just going to be very, very list-driven. So we'll figure that one out. For those of you that are brand new, this is a very straightforward, easy class. It's going to be discussion-based. I threw a lot of information, basic information at people last week, and there's not a thing that we can't catch you up on. So I'm very happy that you came tonight, okay? The same for anybody that's here. Restrooms are right around the corner in the back. So, again, if you need to get up and get a drink, if you need to go to the restroom, please do. We're going to be doing some basic meditation, and so if people, again, this is an introductory class. If you'd like to try sitting on the floor during the meditations and get up and down, try some of the different positions and seats, feel free. We're not overly structured here. I'm going to try, Patty, I'm going to have you, if we get a chance to have some discussion, y'all actually talk, I'm going to have you use the microphones. So that we can all hear, and so that, I'll just have you hang on to that for now, so that we can all hear, and so that when people go back to listening to the recordings, they don't have, you know, that big black hole. And I do that. I'll listen to the recordings from the Kanapa Center, from the different teachings. And it's really kind of irritating, good opportunity to practice patience, when you can't hear the question, and when the class leader or the teacher doesn't repeat the question, and then you're kind of left guessing what the question was, and that can be a little frustrating, and you don't, it's hard to learn when you can't hear what they're talking about. Okay, so now obviously this is one of those times where I need to get centered, because I didn't get any of the things done for this class that I meant to do this week. I don't have my tech people that are usually here to support me, so this is one of those really good opportunities for me to practice what I talk about, because it would be very easy for me to be very flustered right now because I was late getting here. I don't have my stuff, don't have the people that usually support, and that's okay. So we're just going to go with it, all right? But that's part of why we practice, because guess what? This is life, and it happens all the time. The very first time that I taught this course, the very first time, and I was so excited. So, Patty, your excitement about maybe being able to do this. Man, I had my flip charts. It was like 3-4 years ago. I was so ready. And I went out. I had my car loaded, got all this stuff. I was going to be here early, and I went out, and my car wouldn't start. And it was complete panic set in. I was completely, because I live like 45 minutes away. And I completely was like flustered and panicking, and my husband came out and he said, well, are you walking or are you talking? And it was like it grounded me right there and then, because it's like, you know, that's exactly what happens. That's exactly why we practice, so that we don't let the things that happen out there upset us so much. So there's a handout there that just has some of the basic information, some of the stuff we covered. It's very basic. It's on that table right back there for those of you that might not have made it. Patty can pass that out. It's just basically a quick overview, and it's got some basic information. I'm going to be honest and tell you, I haven't even looked at that thing in 2 years, so I'm hoping it's got what I want it to say on there. So again, this is Buddhism in a Nutshell, Class 2. All right, our plan for tonight is we're going to do a brief review, okay, as to what we talked about last class. We're going to go through a little bit more of the history of Buddhism, and then we're going to get into a more detailed discussion of the role of the mind in Tibetan Buddhism, and we're going to get into a more detailed discussion of the Four Noble Truths, because we started that a little bit last time. But for right now, what I'd like to do is every single class, we're going to start with a brief meditation. Oh, there's the sheet. Okay, that's good. That's the sheet that's out there. I approve. We can use that. That's good. So we're going to do a brief meditation at the beginning, of the class and a brief meditation at the end of the class. Because meditation is the core tool that we use to look at our minds. And as I talked about briefly, we have two types of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. One is concentration meditation. The other is analytical meditation. The concentration meditation is learning how to kind of yoke, how to control the mind. It's like going to the gym to work with your muscles before you need them for some big event. So the concentration meditation, the analogy is there that we are going to learn to focus our mind so that when we go into an analytical meditation where we're actually going to work more with the mind, we have the control. Because from a Tibetan Buddhist aspect, you can't just sit there and think of nothing. Meditation is not just zoning out and thinking of nothing. From a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, that's not even possible. Your mind can't think. Let me try it. Go for it. You can't. You can't think of nothing. So the concentration meditation, we're going to choose an object. We're going to focus on that object, and we're going to go through it. Okay? So this is just your basic little touch on meditation for those of you that have never done it, or for those of you that have meditated but used different techniques. So these are straight up Tibetan Buddhist meditation, simple concentration meditation. And I'm going to start with this, the 7-point meditation posture. And again, I kind of tend to read these things because when I do meditation, I've done this so much that I really do this more as a glance. You know, I just can do it. And so I don't think about it, and so it's hard when you do it and you don't think about it to actually explain it, because I want you to understand it and hear it as it is meant to be explained, so I don't miss anything. So I'm going to read this while we get in a position, okay? So this is one of the basic handouts that's on the Kadampa Center website, so you can print this out for yourself. My hope and goal is that you actually go through some of these things during the week. This is your chance to experiment with some of these things. So we're going to just touch on it in class, and then hopefully you'll be testing it during the week and seeing if some of the stuff works for you. So we're going to do a very brief meditation. And we're going to start with the 7-point meditation posture. If you're sitting on the floor, you can be grounded. You can be in the half lotus, the full lotus, whatever works for you. Sit with your legs crossed. If you're sitting in a chair, have both feet comfortably and firmly on the ground. If you need to put a cushion underneath your feet to raise it up a little bit, number one, it's not as cold, and number two, it can give you a little bit more grounded position. Again, none of this stuff is holy, okay? This is about giving you a base posture that you can maintain for a long period of time. There is nothing special about this other than the fact that these are very tried and true positions and techniques that have been used for over 2,500 years. They're proven, and so we follow them because it's been factually proven to work. So sitting on a firm cushion also raises your rear end a little bit higher than your knees if you're sitting on the floor, so it's about blood flow and giving you that firm base. If you're sitting on a chair, then you can use the bench. You've seen benches out there. In fact, I think there's one that's being given away if you want to. So you've got meditation benches. You've got chairs. You've got the cushions. You've got different styles of cushions. Take this opportunity to check it out and see what will work. So keep your legs in a comfortable, stable position. Your arms, hold your hands loosely in your lap. In our tradition, we hold the right hand resting in the palm of the left. Okay, so we do it like that. We touch our thumbs to create a teardrop, and we put it in the base just a little bit below our navel. this is actually kind of it's about giving. A lot of the techniques and a lot of things we do, there's layers and layers and layers of meaning. But some of this is what happens by doing this is that it keeps your arms a little bit away from your body. Okay, and what does that allow? Common sense. It's airflow. It allows airflow through your arms, so it's a little bit more comfortable. So hold your hands loosely in your lap, your right hand resting in the palm of your left, palms upward, thumbs lightly touching, forming the shape of a teardrop or flame. That's my phone. Sorry. Your hands should be resting about 2 to 3 inches below the navel. Shoulders and arms should be relaxed. Arms should be slightly akimbo, leaving a bit of space between your arms and your body to allow air to circulate. This helps to prevent sleepiness during meditation. Your back is most important. It should be straight, held relaxed and fully upright, as if the vertebrae were a stack of blocks effortlessly resting on a pile. This helps your energy to flow freely and contributes greatly to the clarity and alertness of your mind in meditation. The position of your legs can contribute greatly to how easy it is to maintain a straight back. Often the higher the cushion is under your rear and the lower your knees, the easier it is to keep a straight back, and you should experiment to see what works for you. So if you're sitting in a chair, rather than leaning back in the chair, sit up just a little bit. Okay, and again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to give a comfortable position. You can actually, once you do this for a while, you can feel yourself settle into it. If you're leaning back, you might get tired. You might get sleepy, and it kind of contributes to sleepiness. If you're sitting too far forward, you kind of tend to get a hunched back. So you can feel yourself settling into this with a straight back, not stiff, but straight. Your eyes, in the beginning, it's often easier to concentrate with your eyes fully closed. It's totally fine, but as you gain some experience with meditation, it's recommended that you learn to leave your eyes slightly open to admit a little light, and that you direct your gaze downwards, not really focusing on anything in particular. Closing the eyes completely may create a tendency towards sluggishness, sleep, or daydreaming, all of which are obstacles to clear meditation. Your jaw and your mouth should be relaxed with your teeth slightly apart, so you're not clenching your lips. Okay, your lips can be slightly touching. Your tongue should rest lightly upon your upper palate with the tip lightly touching the back of the upper teeth. This reduces the flow of saliva and the need to swallow, and these automatic body actions can be a hindrance to deepening your concentration as they can become distractions. Your head should be just slightly inclined forward so that your gaze is directed naturally toward the floor in front of you. If your chin is held too high, you may have problems with mental wandering and distraction. If you drop your head too far forward, this can bring mental dullness or sleepiness. So again, you're trying to create a comfortable position that you can hold for a length of time. There's nothing, you know, really spiritual or holy about this. It's about getting your body in a comfortable position that won't distract you. It won't cause you to become too sleepy, or it won't allow for a lot of distractions from the outside world. So it's just kind of learning to settle into this. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to set an intention. Okay? I'm sitting here on this cushion or in this chair at Kadampa Center because I think it might make me a better person. I'm obviously here looking for something. I'm not quite sure what yet. But the very merest thing is that maybe sitting here on a cushion in Kadampa Center will help me quiet my mind, okay, for my own benefit. And then the Mahayana intention, the great motivation, is that I'm doing this for the benefit of others. Okay, we know that ripple effect. I know that if I'm a nicer, kinder person, that's better for my family and my friends. And you know what? Push it out just a little bit further. Maybe it's better for all the people that meet me, and it's better for the people that I don't meet, but who I will touch in some way just through the other people that are part of my life. And the greatest Mahayana intention is that I'm doing it for the benefit of all beings, people I know, people I don't know, other sentient beings, whether animals, you know, any sentient being. By sitting here on this cushion at Kadampa Center, maybe I can affect all sentient beings. Just that's why are you doing this? Why are you here? And make it be a wish, an aspirational wish to do well for others. And once you set that motivation, focus your attention on your breathing. Breathe naturally and become present in the moment in the place where you are. Focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in the meditation. Focus your attention on your physical body. Find the most suitable sitting position for meditation. Make sure your spine is straight and erect, and you're in a position which you can be aware and awake, but not stiff or rigid. Focus your attention on the top of your head. Move down slowly through the head, the skull, the back of the head, and the ears, releasing any tension in your brow. Move down through your face, checking the jaw to see if you're holding or clenching any tension there. Keep a normal, natural breath moving through your system while you do this. Each time you exhale, just relax a little bit more into this posture, letting go any tension and any anxiety. Moving down through the neck and shoulders, where a lot of our tension is usually stored, check to see these areas. How are they for you? Down through the arms, elbows and wrists, the hands and fingers, and let go of any tension that you're holding down there. Move down through your torso, releasing any tension from your back and your chest. Just breathing into it. Your waist and your hips, your buttocks, releasing the tension in your thighs, your knees, just breathing into any discomfort you may feel there, expanding the space that is there. Release any tension in your legs and your ankles and feet, and let it go all the way out through your toes. Take a moment now to focus on the lowermost part of your body that comes into contact with your cushion or the chair. And feel the substance of your body as it makes that contact. Feel the weight and substance of this physical form. Note places where one part of your body is touching another. Note any discomfort you may feel in your body. Just notice this. There's no need to fix it or have judgment or opinions. You're just noticing it as you scan the body. And as you notice, you can see if you can bring a bit more relaxation, a bit more of the breath into those places. Note your breathing. The movement of the abdomen or the chest as the air is moving in and out. Notice the curve of your arms, your shoulders, and the body. Relax and take a deep breath, releasing any lasting tension. And finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights into the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Bring your attention back to the room. Okay, that's actually handout number 7, and it's called Scanning the Body. And again, there's several handouts on the Kadampa Center website. One is the 7-point meditation posture, and then there are a couple of different concentration meditations that we're going to be doing throughout our time together. My plan is to do a concentration meditation at the beginning of class, a concentration meditation at the end of class, and maybe on that fifth class, that maybe at the end of that we'll actually try an analytical meditation. Okay? So it gives us a little bit of a basis so that you're kind of introduced to it. Has anybody in this class taken the Meditation 101 course? Okay, so you're going to be very familiar with some of these things. Meditation 101 and Buddhism in a Nutshell are two courses that alternate. Okay, so if you haven't taken that class, it's a perfect next step. And if you start with Meditation 101, then Buddhism in a Nutshell is the perfect next step for that. And then once you've taken both of those courses, we have additional next steps that we'll talk about at the end of this class. Okay, now I noticed that air turned back on. Are you guys hot, cold? Everybody's doing okay? I'm going to try to get us to a standard. So that if those of you that remember last class, we talked about impermanence a little bit. We're going to talk about that more. So first we're too hot, then we're too cold, now we're too hot, and then we're too cold, so we're never happy with what's going on. Does anybody have any questions that came up during the week from last class? Let's just go ahead and go there first. Anybody have any questions at all from the last class? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, I'm clear on the concentration
okay.
Meditation.
Hang on just a second. Patty, can we pass the mic up here? Right here. So I'm going to seriously try. And you guys help me. So if somebody starts talking and I don't say something, everybody yell, mic.
Okay, so I'm clear on what concentration meditation is supposed to be like.
Okay.
So then how does that sort of segue into analytical meditation?
Okay, so the concentration meditation, we're going to pick something to kind of work on, specifically to focus on. Concentration is about learning to focus and really control the mind. I think we've used the breath last time, and this time we just scanned the body. So we chose an object, we chose the breath, we chose the body, and you were supposed to stay there. Okay, so in that meditation, and right now you guys are doing where I'm narrating, okay? So you're listening to my voice tell you what to do, right? Well, guess what? When you're home alone, my voice isn't there. So you have to be telling your mind what to do. And so when you're working on the breath and you're counting, we're going to do some of these, you know, maybe at the end of this class, where I'm just going to be quiet and y'all are going to have to concentrate and focus on these things. So what's going to happen, let's say we're counting the breaths, okay? It'll be one of the meditations. I'll do that one at the end. I'm going to tell you, here's what you do, and then I'm going to be quiet, and you're going to try just to do that. And you're going to find your mind is all the way over here. You're going to be listening for something. You're going to be thinking, I've got to do this at the end of class. I'm bummed about this that happened today. Your mind is going to wander. And the job of meditation is to pull it back to what we're supposed to be concentrating on. That's actually what meditation is. It means to become familiar with. I want you to become familiar with the breath. So it's not just sitting there and being able to just concentrate. It's being able to take your mind and pull it back. Okay, that's what meditation is. You're going to hear distractions. We're going to be in here. There's a train that goes by here that is so loud, and your mind is going to go, oh, train, it's loud, it's irritating. You know, whatever your mind thoughts are, your job is to come back to the meditation. So to become familiar. So the better you get with that, then the longer, once you start analytically working with something, okay, that's when we're going to use the mind to work on the mind, your mind is going to be stronger and able to focus more. So the concentration meditation is a workout. You're going to be learning to use your mind and to focus your mind so that you can concentrate more. And then when we get into analytical, we're going to be working with it. We're going to be working on specific subjects. We're going to be working on love or anger, specific things, you know, concepts. And that's where you literally will sit there and argue with yourself. Okay? You're going to debate with yourself about certain subjects. Okay? But that's learning that when you're doing it, that you're working on that subject. You're not making your grocery list or worrying about what you're going to cook for dinner tonight or worrying about next weekend when your in-laws come and you got to do. So you're working right here. So back in the day, okay, when I started with meditation, because I've done everything from transcendental, you name it, I did all the types of it. I remember actually even sitting in there trying to do this, and I was decorating my meditation room. It's like, it'd be so cool if this was this. And it's like, I really kind of like more the Zen look because it's green. You know, or my cats come in. My cats like to meditate with me. Yeah, exactly. So, but it's how do you, these distractions are going to happen. And what you're going to have to do is you've got to start learning to work within these distractions because meditation, you know, it's not about you're going to have this perfect little meditation room where nothing happens. I wish we all had that perfect life. We don't. So working with meditation, you should be able to meditate in the subway downtown New York. You should be able to meditate at home when your children are getting ready and doing things. You've got to learn how to focus the mind. So it's, but now we're working with the mind to work on the mind. So the analogy of that is a mechanic working on a car that's racing down the freeway. It sounds so easy, and it really is easy, but it's we've got to do the work. We've got to do the practice. So does that answer your question? Probably a longer answer than you were looking for, but
very clear now.
Okay. anything else? Of course, I threw so much information at you, and we're going to go over briefly some of it because, again, part of this class is to get the same base so that when we talk about the larger concepts that are going to be coming later, that we all have a foundation of which to build. If we don't have a base, then some of the words that I'm going to say aren't going to make as much sense. So let's do our brief history, and then we'll try to move on. Okay. My flip chart. Prince Siddhartha Gautama was born over 2,500 years ago. We remember all of this stuff. He saw the four sights: sick person, old person, dead body, wandering mendicant. Okay. Before I do this, the people that are here for the first time tonight, are you coming in with any foundation of Buddhism at all or any knowledge? Or is this your first time to a Buddhist center and you're completely just curious?
Well, I don't know if
that's right. Yeah, go for it. So we've got three new people.
I came to the first Buddhist in a nutshell maybe 4 months ago. Maybe 6 months ago.
And who, Elise or Karen?
I'm not sure who was the leader.
Okay,
but it just happens that I was only able to make it to the first one. And that was it. So I really want to start up again.
Okay.
And yeah, so that's
okay. So you actually technically have been through the first class, okay?
And this is my first time here, but I've done a little bit of reading.
Okay. So because a lot of what I'm going to talk about is the historical facts.
I've got a reasonable grasp of that.
Okay. Good. Stop me. Ask questions if you need to. Who else was new first time?
I was at Meditation 101.
Okay.
And then I also started reading Buddhism in a nutshell, the book.
Oh, that's,
been a
yeah.
couple chapters in.
So. That's even better than anything I'm going to say. That's Venerable Amy Miller wrote that. And seriously, go there. Okay? So let's just go through the fast facts. Over 2,500 years ago, this child was born. He was born into a very wealthy family. At the time, they had a seer come in and give a reading, and they told he told his mother and father at the time that this baby is going to grow up to either be a great spiritual leader or a great king. Like anybody, these dads want their children to follow in their own footsteps, so that's the way his dad was raising him. It's again, this is so simple. Let's use Western terms for some of this stuff. They just kept him very sheltered and extremely sheltered. And those of us that have had children, we know how that feels. If we could wrap them in cotton wool so that they never got hurt, we would if we could. But they did it to such an extreme that actually Prince Siddhartha didn't know any of the hardships and suffering and pain that was in the real world. And he actually, he and some of his servants snuck out of the palace and went into the surrounding area in the town where he saw what's called the four sights, a sick person, an old person, a dead body, and a wandering mendicant. It was shocking for somebody who's never seen any of those things, ever. I mean, we're talking he was in his 20s, okay? Never to have seen anything like this, it would be shocking. There's a lot of our family and children that have never seen somebody die. They've never seen somebody truly sick. Never seen dead body, okay? A lot of us, I had you all raise your hands for that. But I'm going to guess that you also had a dead body probably either in a funeral home. So, again, that's a little bit of a, here in the West, we still control even that part of it. So he was so distraught by what he had seen, and he could not wrap his mind around the fact that this is what was going to happen to him, what was going to happen to his loved ones. So he actually left the palace, and he decided, I've got to figure this out. And then he went to the other extreme. So here he'd lived this life of affluence, where he had everything, and then he went to the other extreme of a life of complete withdrawal and asceticism. And we've all seen those pictures of the Buddha with more of a skull-like figure, seeing every rib. So he spent years with some other seekers at the time, and he was trying to meditate and find some of these answers. But he'd gone so far the other way that he discovered, now I've gone too far. And he actually saw a boat that went by with a musician, and that he was playing a stringed guitar type of thing. And the musician said, if I wind these strings too tight, I can't play the music, and if they're too loose, I can't play the music. So that's kind of that analogy for the middle way. And so there was a maiden that fed him and got him back to strength, and he literally thought, I've gone to both extremes, and neither one is the best way to do this. And so he literally sat down at that point, and he looked at his mind. Okay? He just went inward and looked at his mind. He sat under the Bodhi tree, and he looked at his mind. He fought. He did analytical meditation. He fought with his mind. You'll hear some of those terminologies and the words that are in some of the writings where he fought with Mara. Okay? We've all had those thoughts and those self-doubts where I can't do this. Okay? And your mind throws all of this stuff at you. And there came that point where he had sat and he had looked at his mind. It's depicted in a lot of the tantras where he reaches out and he touches the ground and he actually, you know, said, you know, I can do this. You know, as the earth is my witness, I can see it. I can become enlightened. And he became aware. He was enlightened and he saw his mind. He saw past, future, present. He saw his mind. The definition of enlightenment, the definition of Buddha is enlightened one. Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakya means clan. Muni means sage. So he came from the Shakya clan. This is all just that basic stuff. Again, stop me because I'm gonna wing through this stuff now because I want to get to some of the new stuff. What does enlightenment mean? Full awakening. Removing all obscurations, all the negative, and fully developing all the virtuous, all the positive states of mind. Let's go over here again. Now we're going to go back and forth because I want to catch us up. Okay, let's just go through some of these states of mind. You did it last time, but my board got erased. What are some positive states of mind? Shout them out. We don't have to use the mic.
Happiness.
Love. Okay. Happiness. Love.
Empathy.
Again?
Empathy.
Empathy. Okay. What are positive?
Gratitude.
Okay.
Compassion.
Okay. Joy.
Courage.
Okay, so you can kind of see what's going on there. Negative. This is really bad writing. What are some negative states of mind?
Anger.
Hate.
Jealousy.
Greed. It would help if I could spell too, but don't worry about that.
Arrogance.
Fear.
Hate. Yep.
Anxiety.
Okay, so you kind of get the point here. So if we could get rid of all of these, if we could get rid of all of the negative aspects in our mind and just develop these, what would that make? How would we feel? Pretty good? Would you say that that would make you happy if all you had in your mind was this good stuff and you got rid of all that? What's the bottom line to what we're all looking for?
Happiness.
Peace of mind. Happiness. Okay, if you had peace of mind, you'd be happy, wouldn't you? If you were happy, you would probably have peace of mind. So a little bit together there, isn't it? Okay, wouldn't you say everybody in this room just wants to be happy, right? We could agree to that, right? Could I say everybody in the state of North Carolina just wants to be happy? Everybody in the world just wants to be happy, right? How about any sentient being just wants to be happy? Your cat just wants to be happy. He may have different things that you would think would do that.
Take a nap.
Take a nap.
That's mostly what my cat wants.
Yeah, that's about what my cats do too. That makes them happy. Makes me really happy when they take a nap in my lap. So, but can't you agree with that? It's about happiness. We just want to be happy. It's that simple, right? It really is that simple. We just want to be happy. If we can get rid of all of the negative in our minds and just have all of these positive things, we'd probably be pretty happy. So the Buddha becomes enlightened by removing all the aspirations. He did it. He got rid of all those. And he fully developed all the virtuous states of mind. Because he is not a god, he was not a god, he did not get up and be able to just make us all Buddhas. Because he's not a god. He's a man who became enlightened. So he did the next best thing. He started to teach. Okay? He became a teacher. He did not create enlightenment. He discovered it. So it's kind of like Sir Isaac Newton discovering the law of gravity. Okay? I'm going to come back to that. Okay? That's a natural law, the law of gravity. And Sir Isaac Newton, he discovered it. He did not create it. So that's the Buddha. That's a really good description of the Buddha. He is a teacher. He discovered it. The first teaching that he did was, and they call it the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. Okay, so now we're going to start to get into some of these definitions, because once we get these definitions, when we start talking the concepts, we'll be on the same page. All right, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the first teaching that he did, is the Four Noble Truths. Okay, that's one of the handouts, and I had it up on the board, and I probably will rewrite it up there in a little bit. So the Four Noble Truths that we went over last week. But Dharma means that which protects. That's the actual technical term of it. We have conventional Dharma, which means the teachings, our actions. Okay, and the ultimate Dharma is the realizations that we have, those aha moments of how this works and why this works. Okay, along this path to be liberated and to become enlightened. And Buddhism is about the mind. I'm going to repeat that over and over again. Everything in this room, all of these tankas, all of these colors, all of these symbols, all of these paintings, all of these flowers, all of these water bowls, every single thing in here is about the mind. Then it spread. Buddhism spread. India, Sri Lanka, Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Tibet. All of the different Buddhist traditions, they start to morph a little bit, just like anything else. So when it goes into Vietnam, you have the different flavorings of it, and the Buddha looks a little bit differently. When you go into Japan and Chinese Buddhism, but you can kind of tell, like, the different looks. That's just socioeconomic changes. The core is always the same, but he's going to look a little bit more Asian over here. He's going to look a little bit more Western. The core is always the same. It just changes. It morphs a little bit just because of the culture that you're in. Two main strains, Hinayana or Theravada. That means individual release from suffering, nirvana. And the Mahayana tradition is more universal. We're not only reaching nirvana, but we're going for enlightenment and to benefit all. You'll see different things where they'll call these the greater vehicle or the lesser vehicle. It doesn't really mean better than, because you really, if you were going to save somebody's life from drowning, you better know how to swim yourself before you can help anybody else. So the Mahayana just path just means basically we're going through all of this at the same time. We don't have to wait. Okay, it is about, but the purpose of why we're doing it is really not so much for ourselves, but for the benefit of all. Okay, Tibetan Buddhism, four schools, Nyingma, Kagyu, Sakya, and Gelug. The Dalai Lama is part of the Gelug tradition, okay, Gelugpa tradition. Kadampa Center is part of that same tradition. We are a Tibetan Buddhist in the Gelug tradition. And what does that mean? Okay, so the Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of all of it, but there are just different focuses. And the Gelug is very much a traditional, it's very... What's a good way to put it? It's very school-focused. You actually see people coming here, even on Sundays, where it's all a teaching to us. It's a way of life. In fact, the name Kadampa is taken from those who take the Buddhist practice, the Buddhist teachings into their everyday life. So that's what that word Kadampa actually means, those who take the Buddhist practice, the Buddhist teachings into their everyday life. And so we're Gelug. They're all the same. They all have the same core, we just have a few different focuses. And any of you guys that ever want to put anything in there, feel free. Don't just sit back there. So again, I'm going through this really fast. Buddhism is about the mind. Everything's about the mind. Developing the positive leads to happiness. Removing the negative that caused suffering. That's basically the definition of enlightenment. Okay. Any questions? Because we're moving on. I'm sorry to go through this so fast. Everybody's got it so far? Okay, what is the mind? Let's get on the same page for what is the mind. Okay, so it is not the brain. We're not talking about the physical brain. We are talking about I think it's The Art of Happiness, one of my favorite books, where the Dalai Lama, I'm going to see if I can look this up. The Dalai Lama actually has a definition of the mind that I really love that actually, I think, pulls a little bit more of the heart into it and emotions into it a little bit. It's not so clinical. But what is the mind? You can use mind and consciousness a little bit together, a little bit the same thing, okay? Non-physical, it's not the brain. Here comes that train I talked about. Wait till it goes by. It can get real loud sometimes. Oh, that's not too bad. Okay, the mind, non-physical, it is not the brain. It is clear. The mind is clear. Like a clear sky, a clear lake, a mirror. So if you picture a clear sky, with that beautiful clear sky, and then you see clouds coming through. Okay, if you kind of see the analogy of the mind is the clear sky and the clouds are your thoughts. Okay, you have the choice of whether or not you put positive thoughts in there or negative thoughts. But your mind itself is the clear sky. The mind is aware. So in our Western world, we think about the senses, sight, sound, smell, touch, and taste, right? Those are kind of the five senses that we're taught. In Tibetan Buddhism, we actually talk about it with six. And the sixth one is mental awareness. So it's that awareness that we have. The mind is aware. Its function is to know. That's what its job is, to know. And there's no beginning. And it is continually changing. This is where that concept of rebirth we're going to talk about. Rebirth and reincarnation are slightly different, and we'll explain that a little bit. But we have to get this down. We have to understand this before we can talk about that. So it helps you to understand it. So mind or consciousness, non-physical, it's not the brain. It's clear. It's aware. Its function is to know. And there's no beginning, and it's continually changing. So it's like a river, okay? Your mind is that river, okay? It's continually changing. If you step in a river here, and then you get out and you step in a river down there, you're still in the river, but it's different. So you're still in that river. And we have the ability to change our minds. We have the ability to change our minds. That is one of the core concepts of Buddhism. Okay, we have the ability to work with our minds and change our minds. And that is, in some ways, what's going to lead us to what it means to be Buddhist. Oh, I wish I had my PowerPoint because I had some really cool pictures. Okay. Okay, so I say that. We have the ability to change our minds. How do we do that? Okay, what are some of your thoughts about how you would go about changing your mind? How about, I'm not talking about changing the decision, because we say that all the time. Oh, I've changed my mind. Oh, I've changed my mind. Okay, these are some of those things that we talk about in our everyday language. What do I mean by that we have the ability to change our mind? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
Everybody's so quiet. Perceived things.
How we perceive things might be one way. What else?
How we react to things.
How we react to things. Okay, so both of those actually are phenomenally perfect. Okay, how do we, what does it mean to be Buddhist? Because what it means to be Buddhist is that we, where do you look for happiness? Where are you looking for things? Okay, we tend to think, okay, if I had some more money, I'd be happy. If I had that new house, that would make me happy. I have that new outfit. If I had a new outfit for the party coming up, that would make me happy. I had that new computer, that would make me happy. If I had that new job, or Bill just made me really happy because he took me out to lunch the other day. Bill made me happy. You see, our everyday talk, we talk like that. Oh, I'm happy today. Somebody calls you up. How's your day going? I'm really happy today because this, and this happened, right? We say those things, right? So that means that we're putting the happiness out there, isn't it? So if the happiness was really out there, and the happiness really was about the money, the fame, all of these things, then you could probably say that 70% of the people in Hollywood should be happy, shouldn't they?
Yes,
70%. 70%. They'd be happy. If happiness was really that, all of the people that have these things would be happy. And how about then you could turn around that all these people that are suffering from cancer, all these people that are suffering from whatever cause they have, they're in a wheelchair. They should never be happy, should they? Because they have the suffering, right? I mean, we should be able to say that. If that was factually true, if it was all about what's going on out there, then everybody that has things should be happy, and everybody that doesn't have the things shouldn't be happy, right? The Dalai Lama, okay, he lives in exile. His people are suffering all the time. I know people that are handicapped. They live in wheelchairs. Okay, they're some of the happiest people I know because they're working with their minds. They're not looking out there. They're looking in here. So how you react to the things that are happening out there, you have that choice. You have the choice of how you react to living with cancer. You have the choice of how to react when you don't have that job. You have the choice. And you can work with your mind because some of the happiest people, you know, think about the people that you know. This doesn't even have to be my experience. Think about the people that you know, you've seen on television, you know, that are generally happy people. They shouldn't be, or you think that they have less than you or more than you. It's really interesting when you start having that perspective of, you know, how, I don't understand how they can be so happy, but they don't have this, or they don't have that. Is this making a little bit of sense? I feel like you guys are so quiet. I hate being the only one talking. Okay, so there's technical definitions to things for everything, and I'm going to start making sure that I give them to you. Because, again, it's about being, we've got to be on the same page. So, the technical term for being a Buddhist, okay, is one who has taken refuge in the three jewels of refuge, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and who accept the philosophical worldview of the four seals. All composite phenomena are impermanent. Just go with me on this. I'll explain it all later. All contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering. All things and events are devoid of self-existence, and nirvana is true peace. We'll get to some of that terminology, but basically we're saying those who are looking in here, those who are using their mind to see reality the way it really is, instead of putting all of the different labels and things, we're actually looking in here to see reality. Okay? I guess that's, feel free to change anything if you want to add to it. It's really hard to get this base going. Okay. And old school. Okay. Everything, I'm going to be a little careful here. So how do we do these things? We look at our mind. You study and you practice. You study and you practice. What are you studying? For us, it's the Lam Rim. For us, it's the Lam Rim. It's the Lam Rim is basically the original Buddhist for Dummies. Okay? It was written hundreds and hundreds of years ago, thousands actually. It is the Buddhist teachings all wrapped up into a nice little organizational chart. Okay, and you'll hear us talk about the LAMRIM. It's a step-by-step graduated path. Do this, do this, do this, do this. Right about the time you do this and you think you've got it, then you got to back up and do it again because you really don't. It's like peeling that level or that layer of an onion. Everything has deeper meanings. Okay, and right about the time you think you get it, that's when you really discover how little you really do, okay? And one of the things that I do is that when I'm going through things and I hear terminology that I don't understand, rather than just throwing it away, I'll actually put it on a little bookshelf. I have a mental bookshelf in my mind, and I'll put it up on the shelf because I guarantee you in a month or 2 months I'm going to hear something that allows me, that's what they mean. That's what it means, and you can pull it back off. But the LAMRIM is the graduated path. It's all the Buddhist teachings kind of wrapped into this really nice lesson plan of how to be happy. That's basically it. It is the original Buddhism for dummies. We talked about the Four Noble Truths. What time is it? We're doing okay. Okay, handout number 4. Okay. So let's go through this again because, again, the Four Noble Truths, the first turning of the wheel, the first lesson that the Buddha gave, has the entire path in that teaching. Okay? I'm going to have trouble with this board. What's the first Noble Truth? Anybody remember?
The
truth of suffering. Okay, what's the second one? Third? And the fourth? Truth of the path. Okay, so remember we talked about that doctor analogy? The first one, you have to admit that you're sick, okay? So, because you're not going to go to the doctor if you don't know you're sick, right? So you have to admit that there's something wrong. I'm sick, something's wrong. Then you go to the doctor and you get the diagnosis, the truth of the cause. Here's why, okay? The truth of the cessation. You get the medicine, you're going to get that prescription, and then you're going to take the prescription. It doesn't do you any good to go through all these steps and get the medicine and have it sit on the counter and you don't actually take it. It's that simple. Okay? So, the truth of suffering, we've got to diagnose it. Now, this is where I talked about that everybody talks about, oh, Buddhists, all they ever talk about is suffering. Just turn it around. The truth of happiness. The truth of happiness, the truth of the cause of happiness, how to be happy, and here's how to do it. Okay? I can't express enough how simple this is. It's easy to talk about it. If you can understand these concepts, it is this simple. It's hard to practice consistently. It's hard to do it. Again, now you are the mechanic working on your mind while it's racing down the freeway. But if you can always bring yourself back to these simple concepts, you'll start to see it. Okay? I promise you, you will start to see it, even in this short class time that we have. If I give you some of these little observations, and if you actually do them, then I guarantee you, you're going to see how this can work. All right? It really is that simple. It's not easy to do, or we'd all be Buddhas, right? But it's really that simple. Okay? So, admit that you're sick. So now let's go down. What are we sick with, shall we? I need... I don't know where all this stuff is.
I mean, there's a reason for cold, novel.
There's a reason for...
Yeah, why we are calling, or I know Buddha called novel, to be some particular meaning called noble truths?
So his question is, why is it called the noble truths? Okay, so the Buddha didn't teach in English. Okay, so I'm going to be careful with what I say here because we're actually into the third language or fourth language that was originally translated. So noble could be used aspirational, Okay, or, you know, what are some of the definitions of noble that we're looking for? You know, the four really good. So noble, I think, is meaning to me high, aspirational, beautiful, you know, perfect truths. So you can kind of pick your word there, because noble is being used in a term, I think, that it means here are the simple, high truths of, oh, he'd look at you. So I don't, for some reason, there's nothing was out here. The eraser. You rock. Thank you. This is Steve. So the Four Noble Truths, I think, is used in that manner. And again, the Buddha, from Pali to Sanskrit, you know.
Okay. Sorry. It could be just gentle, righteous, virtuous, worthy,
yep,
honorable, decent, moral, ethical.
Yep, those are all wonderful words for why that particular word. Okay. Do you guys remember the word that I gave you to think of instead of suffering? No, let me back up. Okay, so I gave you a word because we think in this Western world, when I say the word suffering, you have an immediate thing of ouch, dukkha. Very good. Okay, so dukkha. And the reason I brought this word up, okay, dukkha, the reason I bring that word up, again, I'm trying to push you off of your Western perceptions a little bit. Okay, when we think of suffering, we tend to think of the ouch, right? What physically hurts more than anything else. We might add mental suffering to that, maybe, okay, just depending on where you're coming from. Okay, but when you think of the word dukkha, I want you to think of suffering in its large realm, that there are basically three types of major suffering. And it helps when I have everything. Who's coming in?
Thank you, Warren Marcus Berry.
Oh,
you found him.
I'm trying. Yeah, the dry erase. I don't know where they all went. Thank you, Sherry. That's Sherry. She runs the bookstore. And was obviously out there listening. She runs a lot of things. Okay, so I can't find it, so we'll go off of memory. So there's basically three types of suffering. I just need to make sure this isn't permanent. Okay. It's not really that. Okay. Patty, Steve, do you know these?
Suffering of suffering. Suffering of change.
All pervasive. Okay, so the suffering of suffering. The suffering of suffering is what we think of from a Western perspective when we say the word suffering. The ouch. You just broke your leg. You were just in a car accident. You're hurt. Okay, you physically feel pain. That's normally what we think of the suffering of suffering. And I'm really sorry that this stuff isn't showing up a little bit better. Okay, the suffering of change. I go in here and I'm too cold. So I change the air conditioning and now I'm too hot. And then I change it and I'm too cold. I buy a new car and I'm in love with that new car. And a week later somebody hits it. And so it's now a banged up new car. So I'm not happy because my car changed. You got a job and then you lost your job. So your job changed because you lost your job. You have a boyfriend and he decides to leave you. And so that's change. And everything changes. You actually can't hold on to anything in this life. Everything is going to change. But we think we can. You think you're going to hold on to that job forever. Okay, and then outside forces, for whatever reason, the business goes under. They go through a change. They move for whatever reason. You've lost that job. So that's the suffering of change. Things change. Everything makes sense so far? All pervasive suffering. That's a very hard to understand. All pervasive suffering simply because we live in this world. This could almost be the suffering, how you suffer when you actually get what you want. Just because we live in this world, we have this general unease about things because it's just part of our life. We live in samsara, okay? It's very difficult. There's a lot of different layers. I'm not going to go real deep with this, but those are the three basic types of suffering. And that's why we're calling this dukkha, so that when you see it here, we're not thinking of just that Western ouch, okay? So it's looking at these things. Make sure I got this. So it's, pretty soon this is all going to start to come together. That's when I love when you guys get the aha moments. Okay? So, what if I said, I'll do this over here. What time is it? Are we doing okay? Yes. Okay, so we had these negative minds here, right? And we had the positive. I've got the dukkha. Let's lose this now. I'll try to change and find a marker that actually works. There. What if I told you that we have six root delusions? Okay? These are negative minds. These are the main problems. Okay? Anger. You listed a bunch of these already, but we're going to kind of fold them in. And we're going to start working with some of these words. I'm going to buy new markers the next time, I promise. Attachments. Pride. Doubt. Ignorance and wrong view. Okay, what if I could tie 90% of the things we talked about as negative mind into these six root delusions? What if I give you a couple of them specifically tonight and I give you some antidotes for them so that next class you're going to say, oh, I see how that actually works. Okay? So the six root question.
Desire.
Okay, that's going to fall under attachment. Okay, it's good. This is where we're going to talk about these things because just about everything's going to fall under here. So six root delusions. Anger, attachment, pride, doubt, ignorance, and wrong view. Okay, so now we have to understand these. Anger, we've talked about this a little bit. I talked about it last class where I said, you know, I never really looked at that one as a problem for me because I'm not an angry person. I'm not angry. I don't ever have to worry. I just moved on to the other things. I don't need to worry about anger. That's not me. And then I discovered that anger, in its Buddhist perspective, especially from a Tibetan, it actually starts and ramps with impatience. Okay? So, most of us probably are not angry people in here, right? For the most part. But impatient, you're at a red light, and you're frustrated because you got to get to that meeting, you got to go someplace and you hit the red light. How many people in here are ever happy about being at a red light? Anybody? You are?
Yeah, because it's one of my favorite colors.
Oh, well, that's a good. See? Now he's on the path. Okay? So I'm going to tell you some of, again, my triggers because I think that having somebody that can sit here and say how this worked is helpful. We're talking about negative mind. We're talking about how do we get rid of negative mind. My negative mind, I'm driving to a meeting. I'm usually behind. That's the story of my life. And so the red light means that I have to wait. I'm slowing down. So I'm already seeing, you know, two blocks ahead, I got a light. Oh, that's still green. I'm going to hit the red. So my mind is already starting to go negative, right? I come up to that light. Sure, shooting, that car ahead of me didn't go through, and I could have gotten through there. So now I'm pissed at him. I'm still mad at that red light, and I'm frazzled. So I'm impatient, and I'm in negative mind. I am in negative mind. And my negative mind started 3 blocks ago. So now we're talking, 2-3 minutes, right? So I started, and I ramped into impatience. I saw the light. Now I'm directing it at that car that was in front of me because he could have gone. That was only yellow. Okay? So now I'm in negative mind already. And now I'm adding stress to it because I'm going to be late for the meeting. Okay? So now I've got stress. And so it goes. So that whole time that I'm sitting at that light in my mind, I'm torqued. So I'm in negative mind the entire time. And then I guarantee you, by the time that turns green, I'm still in negative. And now I'm thinking, how am I going to go around that guy? Because he's round, round, round. Okay? So that's negative mind. That is negative mind. It's simple. That's a simple thing. We're talking about a red light. But if we can't even start to control our mind on the simple things, how are we ever going to handle the larger things? How are we ever going to handle the larger things? We're in line at the supermarket. Okay, I don't have all minute, I've got my list, I got my stuff, and we're all looking, short line. Ah, and then they have coupons, or they run out of tape, and they have to change it. Or you just sit there, and you've got the new person. Bananas. Yep, or they're talking. They're being nice to each other on my time. Negative mind. It's a simple thing, but it's negative mind, isn't it? So take just 30 seconds out and think about the little times that you have negative mind, because you do it all day long. So-and-so didn't clean the sink up, left the shoes there, left the clothes there, didn't make it into the laundry hamper. It's only 3 feet away, and they drop it right there. Negative mind. Everything that we do all day long can be negative mind, right? Some days it doesn't seem to bother you as much. Some days it bothers you a lot. Wouldn't it be nice if you could go through your life and having the red lights never bother you? So I started to practice. I started this maybe 4 years ago, and this is not my idea, okay, but it works. I try to use triggers, what I call triggers. And let's just use the red light as an example. That was obviously a trigger for me because I always had negative mind about red lights. Because I guarantee you we do not sit there and be happy that somebody else, oh, good, you have a green. I'll sit here while you go. Okay? Try that sometime just for fun this next week. Every single red light that you come to, I want you to try to A, think, oh, you have a green. I'm so happy for you. Okay, you got, yeah, green, go. Mm-hmm. You get to go. Yep, you can do this. I'll wait. Okay, now try to do it without sarcasm. I'm really good at the sarcasm. But that's where you're going to be at first, because you're going to laugh. The first time that you actually do this, and you remember sometime this week, whether it's tomorrow or the day after or whatever, you're going to laugh, and you're going to think, oh, this is dumb. You will really laugh. You will start saying, Sandy said to do this. Okay, let's try it. And you will have sarcasm. That's what's going to go there. Okay, fine. Go. I'm happy for you. Try to turn it just a little bit. Try to think, okay, maybe they probably have a meeting or someplace they're trying to get to. So maybe instead of the sarcasm, maybe just cut them some slack because they're just trying to be happy too. All right? Or take that time, that 2 minutes, to do something positive. I started saying prayers. I have mantras that I do. Mantra is a prayer. It's a mind protector. Okay? I have prayers that I do. And I've been doing this for 4 years now. And I've actually gotten to the point, I am not exaggerating, I am telling the truth. I've actually gotten to the point where I can either go, in my mind, just stay red because I got to finish the prayer. So I can actually sit there now and be happy that I've got a red light and actually want it to go just a little bit longer so I can make sure I get done. Okay? It's taken a lot of time, and I'm not perfect at it always, but I'm definitely better than I used to be. I am better than I used to be at red lights. Because I'm better than I used to be at something as simple as red lights, I have moved on. And now I can do it in the grocery stores too. Okay? I did it just the other day. I was not happy because I was in line, and for whatever reason, the lady that was at the cashier was slower than molasses. I have no clue what was going on with her. So I'm aware of my mind because I do this. So I saw, it may take me longer some days, but I saw I am a negative mind. And it's like all of a sudden, wow, what am I doing? So I'm practicing patience. I'm learning to practice patience because impatience is the first step on this. I usually very rarely ramp into anger. Some people do. But if you can learn to recognize impatience and work with your mind, be aware with the little things, with the red lights, with the line at the grocery stores, what are some other things that you do? You got to go to the DMV. Oh, there's a big bet. Okay? But know it. Start to recognize it. So this week, this is one of your assignments. Go every red light. I want you to try to find some way to do a positive act. Whether it's mentally trying to, without sarcasm, say, I'm really happy that you're... Make up a story. They got to go pick up their child at school. They need to go. They're going to visit their mom in the hospital. They need to go. Make up a story. I don't care. What is going to take you from negative mind to positive mind at a red light? Try it. See how it works. If you are aware of your mind, you become familiar with your mind. That is how to just take little steps, right? That is an actual way to work at it. Find your triggers. What are some triggers that make you angry? Okay? Or find some triggers that will at least bring your awareness. How many of you have seen those apps for the mindfulness bells and stuff that go off on the phones? Okay? So I did that for a while. They have mindfulness bells, so every time you hear this bell, you're supposed to, you know, stop and become aware of your surroundings. Just be more mindful. We all hear that word, mindful. What does that mean? To become aware, right? So I did the app thing for a long time, and, you know, technology obviously is the bane of my existence because, you know, it's what we have. So I let go of some of that, and I have my own triggers that I have made up. I'm going to tell you some of mine because I want you to try to find some things that work for you. An ambulance, okay, a siren and ambulance. We hear too many of them, but we hear them. So that's one of the triggers that I use to become more aware. Somebody at the end of that sound is in pain. So I say a prayer. I say a mantra. I say a prayer because I'm trying to become a more mindful and positive person. And I know that somebody, we all know, somebody at the end of that siren, because there's a siren, somebody's in pain, mentally, physically, whatever. It's a trigger. So I have stoplights. I have ambulances. I have grocery store lines. I can give you a list of the things that I do that I try to use to make myself more mindful. If we can't do the little things, we're never going to be able to handle the big things when they happen. So start to become aware of your mind. Think of triggers that you have or that might be beneficial, whether a negative. This is a negative thing that you're aware of that you do. Try to become aware of it and come up with some methodology, saying a prayer, thinking a story, whatever. We'll come up with some, you know, some more as we go. But how do we actually change our mind? Okay? So we've got the anger. We've got impatience. We know that that will ramp up. Now let's talk about attachment. What time is it? Okay, I'm still doing okay. Okay, attachment. I'm going to give you the actual definition because this is a big word. We're going to be using this a lot. Attachment. From a Western perspective, we look at that word and we think of it as a positive word, don't we? Attachment. We're attached to that person. We're attached to that. But we think of it as a positive word. So attachment from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective means a disturbing thought that exaggerates the positive qualities of an object and wishes to possess it. Okay? A disturbing thought that exaggerates the positive qualities of an object and wishes to possess it. So what does that mean? Let's break that down. Attachment. Okay? I could say attachment has the I involved in it. Okay? So let's pretend, okay, that I've got the most beautiful husband. We're not talking about him. Okay? I'm going to make up that I am in love with Bob. Okay, I'm in love with Bob, and Bob makes me happy, and I'm attached to Bob. Why do I love Bob? Because he makes me happy, because he does all these beautiful things for me. Okay? So I'm attached to Bob, and I think I love Bob, but it's all about me. If I truly love Bob, then I would want him to be happy whether he is with me or not. If Bob breaks up with me, well, guess what? I don't love him anymore, because this attachment, it's all about me. It's not about the love I feel for Bob. So it exaggerates. And this is what we do often in these, especially in relationships in the West. We talk about it. I mean, it's all over television. We want the pretty people. We want these things because they make us happy. Okay? I have attachment for Bob, but that's about me, because he makes me happy because of me. So attachment is not, and we exaggerate it. Do you ever see somebody and you get to know them and you really like them? Okay, in the beginning, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you like this person.
Like my friend Anderson in my school, he was really nice to me in kindergarten, and now I get to know him really well.
Yeah, so that's good. So you got a friend. So you get to know these people and you like them, and then all of a sudden you get to know them a little bit more and then you don't seem to like them as much, and they're not even as good looking as you thought that they were. You ever do that? Okay. Well, that's because of the attachment. You're not looking at them. It's all because of the you. You haven't seen it as clearly. Or the one that I really like that explains it is, if it was really them, then you ever have that friend where you're talking about him, oh, you know, I really like Mary. Do you like Mary? You like Mary too? You don't like Mary? How come you don't like Mary? It's like, well, because she does all this stuff and it's this. But the Mary that I know, I like. The Mary that you know, you don't like. So we have a different perception of Mary, and it's because of the attachment or aversion that we have for that person. So I'm going to keep coming at these things with different explanations and different analogies, because this is going to have you get it, and this way we may have you get it. But some of you are looking at me in complete puzzlement. So I'm trying to think, does this attachment, do you understand the attachment? If I truly love Bob and it wasn't about the attachment that I have for him because of what he does for me, let's go through definitions. That might help. I will find it. Oh, that's somewhat good. Okay, what's the definition of love? What is the definition we can all agree with for the definition of love? The wish that somebody be happy? That's your basic. We're all looking for happiness. So if I truly love somebody, I'd want them to be happy. Let's go with that for a minute. To be happy. Okay, what about compassion? What's the definition of compassion?
Care.
What's that?
Care about
this. Care. Care. To care. What if it's the wish that they not suffer? Okay, that would be care. Let's get real specific. The wish that the other, I'm going to put it this way just for now, not suffer. Okay, if that's basic. Wish for the other person to be happy. No matter what. No matter if I'm involved or not. Okay, if you truly love somebody, it doesn't matter. How many are parents in here? How many are not parents in here? Okay, how many have, those that are not parents, do you have, how many do not have an animal or a pet? Okay, I'm trying to go with my analogies here and see that what would work. For those of you that are parents, we have that total thing with our children, that you want your kids to be happy pretty much no matter what. Even if they do terrible things, you still want them to be happy. You still love them. There's nothing that they could do that's going to take that away, correct? Okay. For those of you that are not parents, whether you have somebody that you love and care about, sometimes it's your parents, your mother, your father, an animal, a pet. You know, we've all felt love. There's different kinds of love. But if you have that love that no matter what, if that being is with you or without you. It's got nothing to do with you. If you can take the I out of it and you just want that being to be happy, that is true love. No matter what. There's no attachment on there. You haven't put strings. You don't have any strings attached to that love. Attachment is having strings. I love you because you do this for me. That's attachment. Okay? I love you because you make me happy. Any of those things have attachment to them.
Like,
go ahead.
Making your attachment important to something else outside yourself.
It's like making your the string, like you're talking about, is like you are making part of your happiness to something. You're connecting it to something outside of yourself.
Yeah, a little bit that way.
It's dependent on. It's sort of dependent on them and not necessarily on yourself.
Yeah. You're kind of making that kind of another question behind you. So yeah, we're getting close.
I was just going to say that I read an analogy about attachment that I find useful, which is if you see like a flower. So this is something that's not necessarily, you know, your pet or a relationship. You see a flower and it's really beautiful. You're not going to pick it out of the ground because it's going to suffer, it's going to die, and its happiness nowhere near anywhere or anything that you need to be happy. So
I know that analogy. I've seen it. I think it's even a Facebook meme where you see if you truly love a flower, you will just leave it be. You won't pick it because if you pick it, it's going to die. So that's actually a great analogy. Okay, so you're out and on a walk and you see this beautiful flower on the path. Okay, and if you were truly love that flower, you would leave it, because if you pick it, it's going to die, because then it becomes about you taking it to be. So it's a good analogy. I've seen that one before, too.
Don't pick it up.
It might, yeah. It's going to, isn't it? It's going to die no matter what.
So you can put it in the
water. Okay, so now let's take it a step further, okay, because now you're going a little bit deeper. I'm going to go deep for just a little bit. Okay, so then it becomes about your intention, doesn't it? Then it becomes about your intention and your meaning for it. So if you want to protect it, okay, you think, oh, my goodness, there's a bad storm and hail coming. So it's your intention. It all becomes about your intention. We're going to talk about intention a little bit later. But, yeah, so that's a good one. Okay, so that's next levels down. We'll go a little bit deeper, but it truly comes. And where does your intention take place? In your mind. So it's about your mind. It's about what you are trying to do. Okay? Love, compassion. That's another one. Okay? So attachment is basically, instead of seeing reality, we create a bigger story to this. It's exaggerating the good qualities of somebody. Attachment is really about exaggerating those good qualities. You're not truly seeing things as they are. And it's got the I involved. Wow, I'm not watching the time again. Okay, we're gonna wing through these things because I've got like 5 minutes left. And I want to finish some of this. Okay, we'll go into some of that in more detail because attachment is important. It's going to come up later. Pride. Okay, 6 root delusions, pride. You talked about this before with arrogance. Pride, okay, I am better than you. Okay, pride. Some of the most amazing people I know, the Dalai Lama is probably an excellent. He is so advanced in his Buddhist training, but he is the simple monk. You will never see him show that pride. Geshe Gelug Choda, who is our resident teacher here, probably one of the most humble people that I have ever met. But he's so advanced in his teachings. Okay, so pride. You see us during prostrations. You see Buddhists during prostrations. That is the antidote to pride. We are not bowing down before false gods. Okay, we are humbling ourselves before the teachings. Okay, back in the day when I first started with this, okay, I had that typical American thing, I don't bow down. That was really, I had an issue with that. Okay, really? Because of the whole bowing down. I didn't actually think about it as pride. So again, part of my thing is I'm going to try it and see if it works. And if I see any difference, and if I do, then I'll keep the practice. And if I don't, you know what, I'll move on to another one. There's 84,000 of them. Okay? But I actually found that the practice of prostrations is a beautiful practice. Okay? It works for me. But it is about humbling yourself before the teachings. So pride is a big one. Doubt, that self-doubt, kind of a little bit that false self-doubt. Again, I'm only going to skin the top of these things. We all have doubts, and that's okay. But to have too much self-doubt and to not push yourself through a little bit, you know, it's a big problem when we just tend to give up too easily, right? It's a negative, okay? Doubt, and I can take about six other definitions of this word. So again, every single one of these probably has about 10 levels of meaning. So you're going to hear something else where they take it a different path. It's all right, okay? Where there's different ways to look at all of these things. Doubt is not a good one. Ignorance is a delusion, okay? Ignorance is a problem. We don't understand, and we've got to kind of start looking at these things. So ignorance, you know, it's just like in the law. Well, oh, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to go 75 and a 20, you know? So ignorance. And wrong view, I'm going to kind of meld some of this together because we have what I will call willful ignorance. Okay? And us in America are terrible for this. I am bad for this. I know certain things. Kind of, but it's like I really don't want to know because if I know that I'm going to have to do something. Okay? We all do willful ignorance all the time. And shame on us. Shame on me. I can list some things and take us down a very depressing path with that. But we do it, so it's a problem, okay? And that's part of my negative mind. So that's something that I work with. Is this all making sense? So just about everything that we do can fold into these, the six root delusions. So again, part of this is going back to the truth of suffering. If we don't diagnose what's wrong, how are we ever going to work with it? Well, you know what? Here it is. We don't have to diagnose it. The Buddha already did. And that's it. So now we just have to figure out how to work with those things, how to learn from them. And we've got to figure out these causes, okay? So the diagnosis we've got, here's the list of causes. I told you Buddhists like lists. We've got lists for lists. I can break all of those down further. More lists. Okay, so we've got the diagnosis. We've got the cause. There's the cause. And now we'll start working on the path to stop it. Make sense? Y'all are so quiet. And guess what we get to talk about next time? We're going to talk about rebirth. We're going to talk about how all this continuity of consciousness breaks down, samsara, and karma. Okay? So that's where we're going to start next week. Okay? I'm not going to go back into the history stuff. We've done that, so every time we'll just keep kind of revolving. Okay? So we're going to hit some big concepts next week. We're actually going to get to the point where we talk about karma. We're going to talk about rebirth. We're going to talk about emptiness. We're going to talk about some of these big concepts that we have, but we're going to keep it up here. Okay? We can deep dive in some of the other classes the Kanapa Center offers, but we're going to kind of keep it up here. It is 8:30. I always try to promise to start and stop on time. So here's what I'm going to offer. For those of you that want to go, go ahead and go, and I'll see you next week, hopefully. I'm pleased that you made it back. If anybody wants to stay, then I can do, I'll do a brief meditation for those who would like to take a few more minutes. But it's okay to go if you need to. I talk too much. I get excited about this class. Okay. And thank you all for spending your time and your gas on coming here tonight. I was really worried thinking that there would be very few people here. Okay. So I'm going to do a brief meditation that's called Counting the Breaths. This is actually a meditation, a concentration meditation that I still use, okay? This is one that works for me. So it's one that I like to do. So again, I've been practicing for years, and I still use these because they work. They work for me. Okay, so you've done the scanning the body. I'm not going to go through the seven postures. I'm going to try to let you do that. Okay, there's a handout so you can read it at home, but I just want you to center yourself, go through those seven-point postures. There's going to be talking and stuff out there. That's okay, because you're going to learn that this is part of what meditation is. Calming the mind. Focus your attention on your breathing. Breathe naturally and just focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present and ready to engage in the meditation. Create an altruistic motivation for this meditation session and think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. Start by focusing your attention at the opening of the nostrils and pay attention to the very subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move, cooler sensations as you inhale, warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air all the way into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath just right there at the opening of your nostrils. And your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations only. As you inhale and exhale, mentally count each inhalation and exhalation together as one. Count from 1 to 10, concentrating on those sensations. And when you reach 10, begin again at 1. So every inhale and exhale is 1. Then the next one, inhale and exhale, would be 2. If you become distracted, if the mind wanders to other things and moves away from the point of concentration, then begin again at 1. Even if you never get past 2, it's not a problem. The point is to train your mind to focus on one point only. So I'm going to let you do this for just a couple of minutes. I'll let you go for 2 minutes. All right? Inhale, exhale, count 1. Do that until you get to 10 and then start over. If you find your mind wandering, then come back to the meditation and start at 1 again. And I'm going to time this so you don't have to worry about it. I'll do 2 minutes. Okay, bring your attention back to the room, and we're going to dedicate that positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. So I've done that meditation for years, and sometimes I'm perfect at it, and I can get to 10 and I can start and do it over and over again. Okay, and I'll do this for 15, 20 minutes, sometimes even longer. All right. Then there have been times when I've sat with that meditation, all of a sudden I found myself on number 71 when I was supposed to stop at 10. That's how my mind is so caught up in it. So I'm not actually paying attention, okay, where I've just gone, I've blown right by 10, and I keep counting. That's not the meditation. The meditation is to be aware. Sometimes I can't even get past 5. My mind is just darting. But that's the practice, okay? So try that one at home. That's a good one. Again, this is up on the website. Thank you all for coming. Do your red light stuff. Try it and see what happens. And if you've got any questions, my email, sandy@blueyonder.tv. Please go ahead and ask them if you don't want to ask them in class. And I hope to see you again. Again, I feel like I was just blathering. But we started. Thank you all for coming. I hope you have a safe week, a great week. And drive safely. I think the weather's getting kind of nasty out there sometimes.